Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Richard Schacht, author of Nietzsche's Kind of Philosophy, Finding His Way, which is published by the University of Chicago Press. It was released last year. The sequel of sorts, complementary in nature, will be Nietzsche Pursued, released, it'll be on September 25th of this year, and it's actually available for pre-order now. Our topic today is a looking backward kind of thing. The new book will be a look into Nietzsche's philosophy of the future and what a future it is now and will be, and I guess we'll see whether Nietzsche is kind of a modern day Nostradamus. Richard is also the editor of the new Norton Anthology of Western Philosophy after Kant, which kind of screwed up him getting this book and the next book done. He's also a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois Urbana. This is his sixth book about Nietzsche, and the seventh will follow closely. So what do we know, me, the lay reader, and my friends, and pretty much everyone in the United States? What do we know of Nietzsche in our modern world? Well, we probably know God is dead. We may know that from the Time magazine cover. We probably know thus or also spake Zarathustra. Maybe we know that from the movie 2001. And then we know the Übermensch, whether we call it the Overman or the Superman, which was kind of no-no because of the comic strip, comic book. But then we also think of him as a Nazi and an anti-Semite, which unfortunately his sister kind of caused. And then if we know more, it's only because we took philosophy 101 and 102, or we actually did become interested in the life and work of a man who was born in 1884, only lived to the age of 55, many of those years in pain, or for want of a better word, also insane. Beginning his career as a philologist, his philosophical works spanned less than two decades, yet here we are 125 years later. And although initially, as Richard encountered in his undergraduate studies, this guy was scorned and then ignored, he's reappeared as a kind of prophet and seminal figure. He's influenced philosophers, writers, musicians from Freud, Jung and Adler to Sartre, Camus, Hermann Hesse, Mann, Wagner, we'll talk about that relationship maybe, Mahler, Strauss. And in the bibliography of this book, there are it's a great bibliography, great notes, great acknowledgments, and great story of the book. But in the bibliography, I counted them, there's over 100 studies listed with the name Nietzsche. So the question is why? What is it about this strange and controversial man that draws so many? I mean, he had a tortured life. He had an arrogance that in my mind was extreme and a kind of dour view of humanity, again, in my mind, and its cultural and moral norms. What is it that keeps us so tuned in, and for Richard and his peers to continue to delve into all of this, much as I do with my book up there, with my books up there about Joyce and Ulysses? So let's find that out. And in so doing, learn more about the man and his work. So welcome, Dick, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show and look forward to this next hour.
Likewise. Well, I don't know where to start, but suppose we start with one of the things let's start with your preface, because you say that your acquaintance with Nietzsche began as an undergraduate, I guess 18, 19, 20 years old, correct?
Right.
So you've been doing this for at least seven decades.
That's
why?
Right.
Why have you been doing it?
Well, I find that Nietzsche doesn't get old in terms of his, I mean, he never got old as a person, but he never gets old as somebody you've really read enough of. You think you've exhausted everything that there is to get out of his thinking, his writing. Depending on what kind of issue I'm thinking about philosophically at the moment, there's something in Nietzsche that I will want to think about as I write about or talk about whatever it is and whatever problem, whether it's human nature or values or morality or any number of things. He's got something provocative and often probing, sometimes off the mark, but about just about every topic that people like me in this philosophy business wonder about, try to think about. I consider him to be not just a philosopher I'm interested in, but a philosophical companion. I mean, he's somebody that I take with me in my head wherever I go, and I'm always in a kind of internal conversation with Nietzsche, thinking about what he might think of what I'm talking about, and what things I want to say about what he was talking about.
It's interesting. I interviewed a guy who wrote a book about, it was called Why Read Moby Dick. And he opined that anything anybody ever wanted to know was contained in that book. And I always wondered whether it was Melville or him that chose to view things that way. Like James Joyce said, I don't really ask much of my reader other than to spend the rest of his life attempting to interpret my book. And you got these guys like, you mentioned Walter Kaufman, but there's Brian Leiter and there's Maud Marie Clark. And even, which is really weird, perhaps the most well-known now due to today's culture and he's touring now is Jordan Peterson. Isn't it interesting how so many people feel, at least, do they feel the same way as you? You must have colloquia all the time.
Well, I think that different people are drawn to Nietzsche for different reasons. And the people that you mentioned certainly have had very different reasons. But I think one of them is that all of us can find in Nietzsche the Nietzsche we want. And so if you take Walter Kaufman, who was my doctoral dissertation supervisor, one of the things he wanted very much out of Nietzsche was he was a Jew, Kaufman was a Jew, and World War II and the Nazis and the 7 million were very much on people's mind. And Kaufman was drawn to him as a humanist and as a kind of psychological philosopher. And Kaufman wanted to get rid of the Nazi reputation that Nietzsche had, thanks to his sister, who sold him as such very falsely and very, I think, tragically, because it's put so much in the way of people. People tend to think about Nazis and whatnot because that's, for a while there, his reputation was captured by his sister. And when he was alive, but not no longer himself, she had her way with them. And so she had her own reasons for wanting that interpretation to fly. So Kaufman tried very hard to correct in the opposite direction, to make Nietzsche out to a kind of a secular humanist, great anti-Nazi, which is closer to the truth, but it also ignores a lot of other things. Brian Leiter likes him because Brian Leiter is a philosophical naturalist of a scientistic sort, and he likes to try to find in Nietzsche support for his reading of Nietzsche as a scientistic naturalist who thinks that the sciences are the answer to everything that we want to know or should want to know. That's completely different from the Nietzsche that Kaufman wanted. And it's completely different from the Nietzsche that I think I find when I read him. And when I wrote Nietzsche's Kind of Philosophy, one of the things I've been trying to do my entire career, but especially in that book, is to take a broad view of Nietzsche, not just have a selective view of what he said here and there, to look at the total range of his writing from his early works to his later ones, and to the very different discussions that he offers to different topics, and see what we find Nietzsche's writings actually showing us, to try to set the record as clearly as possible about the complete picture of Nietzsche as a philosopher in the context of his life and time and his concerns. And he started out not as a philosopher. He never went to undergraduate or graduate school in philosophy. He was a classical philologist. He came, that is, to study classical languages and literatures. That was his only academic position, was as a professor of classical philology at Basel University. But he was drawn to philosophy by the kinds of interests that he had in such things as the Greeks in his his first book, The Birth of Tragedy. It was done as a philology book, but it wound up posing so many philosophical questions that Nietzsche gradually shifted from classical languages and literatures to the problems of the day, to the problems that arise when you pull the rug out from under our feet as a civilization by ceasing to regard the Christian view of the world as even making any sense. Now, where do you go from there if that's what you think about where we're coming from? And so these are I think the things that I point to in Nietzsche and the things that I discuss in relation to some of his most common rubrics need to be straightened out. I try to straighten that out in a way that's neutral in the sense that it tries to do full justice to the range of his writing and thinking.
Well, it's interesting because, as you say, all these people who study him come at it from a different way, and they have the ability to do so because you're talking about a rubric. And it's interesting in the book, you know, the first part goes through each of the works you chose to include. But in the end, it's interesting also that you have these chapters where the labels that we've come to recognize, whether it's nihilism or existentialism or individualism or free spiritedness or naturalism, are all discussed. And it's like, is he putting on these different jackets and coats to become these other things? Or is it an amalgam? Or how is a lay reader supposed to, like, okay, I understand what a naturalist is, in good part because of reading your book, but that to me is absolutely the opposite of nihilism. But is it? I don't know.
Well, that's a very good question, the way you put it. I like the thing about the coats. Actually, it is we who put the coats on Nietzsche. And that's why he looks so different to different ones of us, because Kaufman brings him one coat, and Leiter brings him another coat, and it looks like a different guy. It sounds like a different guy. So I think what you need to do with these rubrics, and as you observe, the second half of the book is a discussion of five rubrics that you listed, and I feel that I sort of owe it to the reception of Nietzsche to say, okay, in what sense and to what extent is Nietzsche a kind of nihilist? What kind of nihilist is he? Because there are very different kinds of nihilists. Same thing for existentialist. If he is some sort of existentialist, what in Nietzsche warrants that rubric? And with each of these rubrics, I wind up concluding that there's some truth in them if you understand them in the right way, but they can also be very misleading, if not downright misrepresenting, if you take that to be the whole story. I mean, you say, how can somebody be both a nihilist and a naturalist? Well, my point here is, I think that if you understand his nihilism right, namely as applying mainly to metaphysical concepts and absolutes and not to everything that we might be able to know or might be able to live by. But it's a nihilism when it comes to classical metaphysical categories and ideas. He wants to get rid of those, but what he's doing is clearing the decks for his kind of naturalism. I mean, his naturalism and his nihilism go hand in hand. If you sweep the table clean of all the metaphysical absolutist concepts that he is opposed to, then the stage is set for you to say, well, okay, if that's not the story, what is the story? So then the natural thing in these days is to take a naturalistic approach if you can't have a supernaturalistic approach. And so that's what Nietzsche, in a way, did. He absolutely thought we needed to naturalize our interpretation of ourselves. But what does that mean? I mean, how far do you take that? Does that mean that he is some sort of mechanistic, materialistic determinist? Or does that mean a different kind of naturalism a naturalism that rejects the God idea. And so that we have to understand ourselves as creatures that have come about in the course of nature doing its thing. But then, does that mean we're just pieces of machinery in nature? Well, no, because for Nietzsche, we have acquired capacities to emancipate ourselves from the determinisms of the merely natural. And this has happened through culture and through the various kinds of transformation of our originally merely natural human nature that Nietzsche thinks we've undergone. So Nietzsche builds his naturalism out of what you can do with the idea of the natural if you get the idea of transformation into your account of the natural.
Well, if that's okay, understood, but, and this is somewhat tautological because I'm using actually one of the rubrics that you've discussed. If I am a part, if I'm a member of the herd, I would like to have a lodestar. Most people look to someone, whether it's George Washington or Donald Trump or Benjamin Franklin or Adlai Stevenson. You look at a person, you know who he is, you know what he stands for. And the herd wants that because they want to be happy, even though they have no reason to be happy. So do I have to be an overman in order to embrace Nietzsche in these various incarnations that I then place him in? Am I entitled? Are you entitled to actually do that? Or as a member of the herd reading your book, am I confused and scared and puzzled because I don't know how to tell my friend or my wife or my class, who is this man? Because there is no definition that I've found, and you guys all confuse me. And some of you guys fight amongst yourselves too.
Yeah, but I'm the one who's right.
I knew you would say that.
He
said there's no right way. Nietzsche said there's no right way.
Well, he didn't say there's no absolutely right way. There are right and wrong ways of understanding. I mean, there's a right way of understanding Christianity for Nietzsche, and there's a wrong way to understand it. His way of understanding Christianity is very different from that of any Christian you would want to meet. But he's got an understanding. The interpretations of these things and interpretations of different kinds of politics, different kinds of art, of Richard Wagner and different views of him. Nietzsche knows that we can have very different views of these things. And he wants us to, first of all, recognize that some things can be interpreted in very different ways, and that's the way it should be because they have many, many different aspects. They can be taken in very different directions. I mean, suppose that I say I'm interested in philosophy. Well, I can take that interest in many different directions within philosophy without getting any of them wrong. It's just that it allows for considerable latitude of how we construe the kind of thing that I want out of philosophy. Other people want other things out of philosophy, so they become different kinds of philosophers.
Well, if you take the most controversial one that I spoke about in the introduction, God is dead. Doesn't mean God is dead. And the Buddhists say, if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. It doesn't mean if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. But then the question is, Time magazine does put that on the cover. Christians look at it as if it's anathema, but that's not what Zarathustra said at all. Yet it is what he said. And how far down does a lay person have to go? And then is there an answer to the question Time posits, is God dead, versus Zarathustra saying God is dead? Because I read that and first thing I think of, oh, he's saying God is dead.
Well, that's figures of speech that they're using there. What God is dead actually means is that the God idea has outlived its believability. So it's the idea of God that has died. There wasn't some being God who was at once upon a time up there in the sky, and then he had a terrible accident and he died. No, that's not. It's the death of the God idea that Nietzsche is using, the phrase God is dead, to sum up. Nietzsche didn't make that phrase up. I mean, that's in Hegel. If you go way back to Hegel, Hegel was the first one who said, God is dead in this sense. But that Hegel was taking it from Christianity, because the big deal event in Christianity is supposed to be that Jesus died on the cross, but then he was resurrected. But God is the original shocker of a God is dead idea goes all the way back to the beginning of Christianity. So people have been using that image that something divine, something that means God, something that we have meant by God has no longer become believable for us, is no longer real for us. But when Hegel, for example, says God is dead, what he means is the traditional God of the Old Testament is dead, the personal God, the God who is a kind of a supreme being. That God is no longer believable. But what we do with the idea of God is turn the God idea into the idea of the inherent spirituality of all of reality that is realizing itself in history. See, that's neat Hegel's view of the resurrected God idea. You transform this idea of a being who was located somewhere to some sort of spirituality that is imbued in the universe. So then
why does he set it against the background of Zarathustra wandering around with this lantern looking for God, the people treating him with scorn as if he's an insane person or an idiot or the town fool? It reminds me of Diogenes walking around and everyone being full of scorn for him, but he's telling the truth. So why does he create this guy? And why, not that he created him, Zoroaster, but why does he put it in a setting where he's defiled by the public, by the herd?
Well, first of all, we should get the origin of the Zarathustra choice in the clear. And Nietzsche chose to have a figure, which he calls Zarathustra, do what he does, because Nietzsche thought that the original Zarathustra, the one that was about 500 years BC, was one of the old prophets who is responsible for the absolutes of good and evil that people have been taught must be true, that things must be absolutely good or must be absolutely evil. That original dichotomy between good and evil, that was Zarathustra's idea. And Nietzsche said that idea underlies a lot of what's wrong with our civilization, with Christianity, with our ethics. So we need to get rid of Zarathustra's concept of good and evil. And so to do that, I need to bring in a new Zarathustra to replace the old Zarathustra. So Nietzsche's character, Zarathustra, in the books is supposed to be the new one who makes up for all the wrongheadedness that the original one was responsible for. That's the reason that he picked that.
Is Zarathustra an Übermensch?
Well, let's then take a moment to say what that means. I think that the Übermensch, which means something different than another type of creature or a superman of maybe superhuman powers or anything like that, it is a higher transformed humanity that he represents. This the Übermensch means, the Mensch means mankind, humankind, but the Übermensch is something that transcends what humanity is today, but in ways that are foreshadowed here and there by various kinds of special excellences that people do achieve. And Nietzsche says, actually, there are higher types of human beings, and there's a kind of Übermensch when you have somebody who is supremely talented in some area, that doesn't mean that they're a total, that everything about them is superior, but it is that excellences are not equally shared. And he's those who are most gifted in various kinds of activity are in those respects a kind of higher humanity. And they're so it's really the idea of human excellence ratcheted up to the next level. That's what the idea, and there isn't any particular thing that's the Übermensch, because the Übermensch is the idea of the self-overcoming of humanity as it becomes something superior to what it was.
But if you're saying that, to put it crudely, if you can glom on to any piece of Nietzsche that you feel like represents your own worldview, then I would say, okay, Elon Musk is, and if your next book is going to be dealing with what Nietzsche thought of the future, then I would say, okay, Elon Musk is an Übermensch. He's a complete outlier. He's accomplished more in this century than anybody else in so many different venues that, okay, that fits my categorization of what an Übermensch is. Am I right? Am I wrong? Does it matter?
As you just said, that fits your idea of what you want it to be. I mean, Nietzsche knows that we can and do have different excellences that we think the most highly of. That we have, like some people think that Musk is the greatest thing who ever walked because he's the richest thing who ever, and also the most inventive, even more so than Henry Ford. Well, that, you're picking your own ideal, and no, we can't stop you from doing that, but we can counterpose other ideals, say, well, think what you will of Musk, but I think that Nietzsche himself, for example, was a better throw than Musk, because he thinks better than most people do. And I value somebody who thinks really well.
Everything you guys do is like, suppose I believe in a solipsistic universe in which only one of us is here. It's non-falsifiable. Every one of you philosophers, everything you say is non-falsifiable because it's not empirical in the slightest. And so where is the inherent, and you know, I have difficulties with philosophy in the first place, but where is the inherent truth? Because you just said, I can have my view, you can have your view, and you jokingly said yours is right. I know you're kidding. And then you say Nietzsche is a better thinker than Musk. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know why that he would say that. But nothing either of us say is non-falsifiable.
Well, I think when we need to talk about the idea of truth or of philosophy that you're flirting with here, and this is actually something that I think is very important in Nietzsche's kind of philosophy, that there are different sorts of activity that philosophy can be thought mainly to consist in. One of them is proving things. People think that that's what philosophy ought to be trying to do. There's another analytic philosophy has a certain kind of results that it values. It doesn't want to go running after questions that can never have answers. So therefore, analytic philosophy doesn't want to talk about those. Let's talk about things that can have a real solution. And then we can all try to find the solution to that problem and then move on to the next one. That's not Nietzsche's kind of philosophy. Nietzsche's kind of philosophy is my kind of philosophy, namely what I call an interpretation kind of philosophy. Philosophy as interpretation rather than philosophy as analysis. And interpretation is attempting to get at the meaning, the truth, the reality of things that we might think about. But you don't. There's no such thing as the absolute right interpretation of much of anything. But Nietzsche thinks, and I think, that the most we can do with big issues in philosophy, or small ones for that matter either, is to do our best to interpret it in accordance with all the different kinds of perspectives and insights we can bring to it. And so what we're after is better interpretation and an interpretation that makes a case for a certain way of making some sense of things. And I think Nietzsche thought that the best thing that philosophy can do is to try to help us make sense of things that perplex us, and then try to understand what larger view of things can incorporate that sort of insight.
Well, if I still continue to play devil's advocate, then if you go to his aphorisms, for example, one, you know, they seem like absolutes to me. Life is suffering, just like Buddhism says, life is suffering. It's a cycle and the eternal recurrence, just like Buddhism. Life is suffering. You keep coming back. You keep coming back till you get it right. Then you're the overman. Then you're a bodhisattva. I mean, that seems fairly straightforward. Or even more so, especially with your new book, whatever kills you, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's a hit song by Kelly Clarkson. It's pop culture now. So, but he said it. He said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. To me, that's an absolute, not subject to interpretation.
I think things like that are one-liners that have a certain punch to them, but Nietzsche would never think that any of his one-liners would be the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
How do you know that?
Because
there's no gloss on it. He just said it.
You read Nietzsche and saying he loves, I mean, if you read him quite a bit, you see he really likes one-liners, zingers. He likes to nail something, but he doesn't. He has many of those. He can't think that any one of those is the ultimate truth of the universe because he keeps throwing more of them at you.
He says if you want to fight a monster, if you want to beat a monster, you got to watch out. You don't become a monster.
Beware of looking down into the abyss, because soon the abyss will be looking into you.
I've been through that one.
He loves those things. He says, if without music, life would have been a mistake.
Yep.
Great, great one-liner.
And woman was God's second mistake. That's a good one.
So there's a thousand of these things. And that's just because he wasn't originally a philosophical writer who was trying to make arguments. What he really was originally was this guy interested in literature and languages and what you can do with languages. And he was all the way along somebody who really cared about the power of words and not just the simple meanings of words. He doesn't want you, like when with the God is dead thing, he doesn't want you to take that literally. There's an idea here that he wants to get across, and he uses that formula to put it on the table. So then you've got to figure out, okay, well, what is the truth that he is, or what is the meaning that he wants to attach to this? And the meaning of the death of God idea, for example, for Nietzsche, is that it pulls the rug out from under us in so many ways. We have to reevaluate so many things if we no longer have this absolute being who gives the marching orders to the universe. If we're home alone, then we've got to make the rules, if there's going to be any rules. So working out the consequences of these big shifts in the ways that we think is what philosophy should be able to help us with, to try to help us rethink the things that now we can't think about as we used to.
When you say all these things, I understand them. And I really, really enjoyed the book. But when I read a paragraph like I'm going to read now, taking out the German that's in brackets, which I understand why you do that for someone who knows German, but especially since Übermensch means so much more than all the translations of it, you write this paragraph, start quoting him. When may we begin to naturalize ourselves in line with the pure, newly discovered, newly redeemed nature, ! And you say, by this he means reinterpret ourselves as human beings in a manner that accords with a reinterpretation of the reality of which we are a part, that we call nature, that has itself been reconceived in an entirely de-deified manner, purged of all traces of the God idea. If you're a layperson, translate into that into a Cliff's Notes paragraph rather than the paragraph you wrote.
Okay. He is wanting us to get on with the task of reinterpreting ourselves, reconceiving of ourselves as human beings, when the answer for that is not just that we were made by God in a particular way and for a particular purpose, and we stand in a particular relationship to the divine. Well, so Nietzsche says, okay, if that's no longer an answer that we can buy to the idea of what human reality is, then how are we going to think about it? And so Nietzsche thinks it's if we're not some sort of creation from on high, then we've got to be something that came along from bottom up. We are something that developed in the world of nature. But now even the part of the paragraph you read had to do with nature itself, because nature itself needs to be reinterpreted if you don't regard it as God's creation. If you think the nature was God's creation, then you have to think, well, God must have done it this way for some kind of purpose. There's got to be some kind of a meaning in it. But no, if there's no God to give it meaning and purpose, then the purification of nature, of all theological, religious hopes and beliefs, that's one of the first things we've got to get used to doing, thinking about nature as just nature that wasn't put there for any reason. It just is what it is. So you have to think, rethink nature non-religiously in order to be able to think about ourselves non-religiously.
Yeah, and naturalism, which this is about, and my definition in my head of what I've read is like, okay, there is no supernatural, there's no mystical, there's no magical. It's just what's here. And if there's any meaning to be derived from it, then it's the meaning we place upon it. But then that is like a tightrope between naturalism and nihilism, unless someone acts upon it.
Well, I mean, let's think about nihilism for a minute here. If you think that there's got to be absolute truths and meanings and for there to be any truth at all, well, then you're in trouble. Because I, Mr. Nihilist, will tell you, there ain't no such thing. I mean, anything with meaning and significance is something that is only in the eye of the beholder. It's not in the thing itself. But Nietzsche says, why should we give up on meaning when it is something that we can bestow and we can create? The world is only as meaningful as we are able to make it. But that means that we've got an open field to run in here. We can make of ourselves and make of nature what we find we can. So you have to get used to living without absolutes in order to live in Nietzsche's brave new world.
What's wrong with just saying we have to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps?
You could boil it down to that. In fact,
okay, then why don't we just boil it down to that then?
Well, because then people will say, well, that just said, this doesn't have any inspiration to it. What Nietzsche wants you to do is to aspire to make something of it, not just say, okay, you know, pull yourself up. But in a way, that's what he's saying, but it's a very embellished version of that.
Well, I mean, the other side of the coin, and apparently there are myriad sides of your coins here. One of the other sides is that nihilism is imbued with a great deal of meaning because it specifically articulates that very thing.
Nihilism, I'm talking about here is no absolutes nihilism.
Okay.
If you say that nihilism is that there's no kind of meaning at all, well, that's not that ignores the fact that there are big chunks of meaningfulness that have been created. They're not going to last forever, but they're there. And so why should we say, well, we don't care about Shakespeare and Tchaikovsky and anything else because it's not absolute. It's not for all eternity. Well, Nietzsche says, why should you think that the only kind of meaning that's worth having is one that's forever? I mean, you've got to learn to think differently about what's worth doing, what's worth having.
Well, you stated his aphorism about music, life without it would be a mistake. So you go to the symphony, you're listening to Mahler's Ninth. And so a nihilist says there's no meaning at all. My definition of nihilism would be there's no meaning at all in you being there. There's no meaning at all in the theater. There's no meaning at all in the musicians or the music. And you only remember six or seven notes and then it all goes away anyway. It's ephemeral. And you talk about the moment. But apparently I'm wrong, because my definition of nihilism is not what you just said, because I can look it up in the dictionary and it's a completely different definition.
Well, there's to say it's not a whole different definition. I mean, that first of all, there are different kinds of nihilism. Like there's a kind of nihilism that says there's no absolute morality, but the science is true in a way that's absolute. Well, so Nietzsche would say, well, actually, that even the natural sciences interpretation of things is, if anything, not incomplete, and it's not necessarily going to be true for every iteration of the universe either, for that matter. But we don't. You shouldn't. You. It is. Let's take it as an example. If I love my wife, that doesn't mean that I shouldn't love her, because she's not going to be around forever. We're not going to be around forever. We should just say to hell with it. Well, now that's a mistake, because you create meanings to live by and live within, because that's basically our job. I mean, to make a world that we want to live in, we need to imbue it with meanings, as well as shape it to our wants and needs, to make the world a human world that is a habitable place while we're around. I mean, we want to make the world one that is worth living in by the standards we create. That's something. That's not nothing. Nietzsche says, if you want meaning, get out there.
Yeah, but then he says, you know, like with regard to the eternal recurrence, it makes me feel really lousy, because he says, I basically have a really lousy life, and I'm going to have that same lousy life over and over again for all of eternity.
Yeah, but look what he says. That is a test. This is not really an actual statement of fact for Nietzsche. It's a test. He says, how well would you have to be imbued with something to be able to say, fine, the eternal recurrence is true, is all there is to it. In other words, it's going to be the same old story, if not the exact same thing, over and over again. Now Nietzsche says, what would it take for you to be able to say, fine, bring it on, as opposed to saying, I'm crushed, I'm going to crawl off in the corner and die. So Nietzsche is saying, what would it take to have you in a state of mind such that this was okay, because what you can do matters more than that. And so that's the point of that whole thing.
Another example for him would be like this idea of this poisonous black snake, and you have the courage to swallow it and to bite off its head. And then you think of Buddhism again, and the idea is, okay, you jump out of a plane, your parachute opens, and then you take a pair of scissors and you cut the lines of the parachute. It's a very easy thing to do. You just let go. The easiest thing in the world to do and the hardest thing in the world to do at the same time. If you're afraid of something like walking over a curb, I don't want to walk over that curb. It scares me. Your whole life is within the constraints of those two curbs, because you're afraid to walk over them. All he's saying is then just do it. Just walk over it.
I'm not sure that I get the drift of that.
People are afraid of the tiniest things, and as long as they remain afraid of them, they're not going to attempt to accomplish it, whether it's surfing or parachuting or walking over a curb. It's only when you face the fear and embrace it, swallow the snake, that you then can move on to this overman concept or whatever it is. That's the way I look at it.
It's not as though there's nothing that you are should be rightly afraid of. I mean, we don't leap off Empire State Building just because we could. We don't. That's not a fear that you should overcome. You should keep that. You don't want to try to cross every line there is, because some of those lines will be disastrous.
Right, but
And others won't be. Like stepping off the curb, okay, you can do that and live to tell the tale.
not if you're
But
scared to do it. If you're scared to do it, you can't. I think a lot of what he talks about has to do with fear, but I don't know whether you really actually ever bring up that concept in your writings or if anybody else does, the concept of fear in Nietzsche's work.
Well, I certainly talk. I mean, he talks about it. I talk about it in the context of, for example, why people cling to religion. I mean, that's one of the. He says we're going to have religion as long as people are afraid to live without it, because they're going to jump for it rather than nothing, or rather than just the absence of it. So Nietzsche says there's a lot of believing that people do that goes back to their not being willing or able to imagine life without it. So Nietzsche understands that, that is a human trait, and he wants that to be among the kinds of traits that we can overcome, that we can put behind us.
Well, another person who's influenced by Nietzsche says, religion is the opiate of the masses. Are you saying
Right.
that's what it is, or is it something different than that? Because
Yeah.
now I feel like I can, there's so many, you said it at the outset, there's so many different interpretations that I'm getting, my head is starting to hurt.
Yeah, well, that's all right. Get used to it. If maybe to be a philosopher, you have to welcome those headaches, because you have
I
to work
do.
out.
Yeah.
Yes. So the you say, is that what I think religion is? Religion
Yeah.
is. I mean, Marx. It was a figure of speech. It was a good. And Nietzsche didn't use that figure of speech. He used other ones. But it's the their point was basically the same in making that claim, that religion is something that is a crutch, and that as long as but. I think they're thinking about Christianity in a negative way for different reasons. Marx is tying it into a certain kind of economic ideology. I mean, Nietzsche is talking more generally. I mean, the opiate of the masses, the point of that saying was that religion is one of the things that the classes in power use to keep the masses subdued. And that's a different use of religion than Nietzsche's. But they're both saying that this is something that is not a healthy thing, but people are hooked on it because either of their fears, or because they've been imbued it, they've been taught to think this way. I mean, people have been taught to think that if there is no God, or if there's no immortality, then life is meaningless and nothing matters. Well, that's a teaching, all right. I mean, it's a useful device. It's like saying you have to be good or you'll go to hell. I mean, that's trying to scare you into a certain kind of behavior. And Nietzsche doesn't think that we have to have those kinds of
Well,
strategies to make people be able to live to see another day, to have meaning in life. And you don't want to be duped by people who have some game to play. They're playing this game on you, so they get you to believe stuff that you don't have to believe. But if you get to believe it, then it's hard to put it down.
if we go back to like what you on the aphorisms and what you've called one-liners and stuff like that. Sometimes one-liners are one-liners because I'm going back to what I said earlier because I'm still not convinced, because they're true. It's like, haste makes waste, a stitch in time saves nine, the early bird gets the worm. The reason why they're cliches is because they're true. That, they're one-liners, but they're true. I
Well, the
don't
early
think.
bird doesn't always get the worm.
Oh,
I mean,
come on. Give me a break.
well,
No.
so So the these worms, these
there might not be any worms. If he's a nihilist, there are no worms. He's going out in the morning to get nothing, and that's what he gets.
No, or there are worms, but he doesn't give a damn. So, I mean, well, I don't. So, does that mean that I should go out and get worms in the morning? No, it doesn't. It's a cute phrase that makes a point, but it's not the only point that needs to be made.
Let's see. I couldn't give you one. I'm trying to, now my mind is all screwed up, but I can't give you one thing that's true, that's absolute. Is 2 + 2 = 4? It wasn't Wait. To Winston Smith in 1984. It wasn't. 2 + 2 wasn't 4 to Winston Smith. I'll give you that.
Well, in our numbering system, it is. If you say, you know, 5 + 5 = 10, but if you're in a base 9 number system, then that can't be right. You have to express it in a different way. I mean, I don't think that.
Are there Platonic ideals?
I mean, you're looking for something that.
I'm looking for something that I can hang my hat on, which is another one.
But they're not ideals. They're ideas. That means blueprints. But Plato meant Plato's ideas were the archetypes of all the kinds of things that can exist. So like the blueprints for the things that get realized in the real world. It's the kind of image of something in its pure essence, like the pure essence of a horse or something like that would be a description of all the traits that the horse has. Now, the blueprint isn't a horse. You have to realize the horse in the real world. And the use of these Platonic ideas of the forms, as he calls them, is that you have blueprints to use, or the world has blueprints to use as it realizes itself.
Well, you know, if you say the essence of, and I've always thought that, I've always been able to look at an oak tree and it radiates its essence. I'm looking at it right now and it radiates its essence to me. But then that takes us back to existentialism.
What do you mean by existentialism there?
I mean, is it existence before essence or essence before existence? That is the tacit, generally accepted kind of existentialism that I know of, which comes.
Well, no. So what did Sartre mean by that? What Sartre meant by that was that you first come into the world without any blueprint as to how you should live your life. Existence comes first, and then essence comes later. Now, he's using essence to read the actual kind of life you make for yourself after you've come into the world. And so he's using the word essence there to mean the specific features of a human being that you wind up realizing right there as the person you are. So first you're born, then you acquire your traits.
But a horse is born a horse. A horse is born essentially a horse.
Right. A horse is born. I mean that. So some things have a more complete picture. I mean, it's not going to be a horse if it doesn't have legs, for example. You've got to have the criteria of a definition. We don't make the horses by designing them the way that we make cars. You know, we invented cars. We didn't invent horses. And so they have nature supplies us, the horse chain, with its nature. But there isn't anything like that when it comes to cars. We have fashioned the idea of this kind of a machine, learned how to make them, they work. It's a different way of something coming. There's an essence of car, there's an essence of horse. They come into the world in different ways. I mean, Plato was thinking of everything having some essence, and then that's the blueprints of reality are all stacked up somewhere and they get realized. And
yeah, like crystalline spheres. But you know what? So, okay, you're right. My brain hurting when we talk about this is great because it means it's like working out. Your muscles get damage right. and rebuild themselves stronger. So I agree with that. And I also agree that because I'm more confused now than before we say hello, I also think that's a good thing too. So as we conclude, let me ask you this, because I talked briefly about it. So this, and I, we don't need to go into it, but I understand why the book was delayed. The second book was delayed because your work on the Norton. But so now as I await September and buying the new book, what I've read is that it deals with, and you said to my wife and your correspondent, and when you send the cut, it has a nice cover too. This one does too. When you said that it deals with the future that Nietzsche envisioned, do you actually bring any examples of the real world into the future that he envisioned, or can you do it?
That maybe you're slightly misunderstanding what I meant by that.
I think I am too.
What kind of philosophy should we have now going forward? It's a philosophy of the future or philosophy for the future. As what kind of philosophy is it going to be most helpful to us to have as we? Is it Nietzsche's kind of philosophy, or is it somebody else's kind of philosophy that's going to be the best kind of philosophy to have around in the future? Well, so I think that Nietzsche, when he was not telling, it's not the future itself that Nietzsche is talking about the future of. It's the future of philosophy. What is philosophy to become?
And I knew me saying Nostradamus was silly, but I mean, I'm looking for practical applications, and I'm looking to you as the wrong person to look for practical applications. I mean, I'm saying, okay, he thought what would be the best future of philosophy? And then I go, well, look at our world today. We're obviously not exercising our right to utilize that best of all future philosophies. It's not like Voltaire. This is certainly not the best of all possible worlds. And so something either needs to change in terms of our philosophical outlook, or we're not going to be here. So that's just me, the regular guy, thinking about it.
Let me just back off and say what I'm meant to be talking about. And I think that what I'm meant to be talking about isn't quite the same thing that you thought I was trying
to. I know.
So philosophy for Nietzsche has been a certain way up through Kant and Hegel and the like, and Hume. And what kind of philosophy does Nietzsche think we want to have now in place of that? We want to have a more naturalistic sort of philosophy, for example, than some of these guys had. But we want to have a philosophy that has more room for the idea of development. It's got to be something that sort of matches up with the scientific things that we have learned about the world in the last couple hundred years, but it doesn't hand over everything. What do we want to be living by in terms of philosophical guidance? We can't just live by the kind of philosophy that takes science as its model, because science it doesn't even get into the areas of what matters and what's worth doing. But what Nietzsche wants to have is a kind of philosophy that deals with human reality and with human possibility, and that helps us understand ourselves better and in order to be able to be healthier and more creative human beings. But what kind of philosophy, in other words, what kind of different philosophy now, Nietzsche's kind of philosophy now, that is for him now, was needed to replace the philosophy that he thought was outmoded, either metaphysical or religious, but neither one of those is the kind of philosophy we need. We needed a more naturalistic kind of philosophy that maps onto the realities of the world as we now know it. But now, as we go forward from here, I think that Nietzsche's kind of philosophy wasn't just a good kind of philosophy for him to be doing. I think it's a good kind of philosophy for us to be doing. And what I try to do in the next book is to talk about the kinds of things that philosophers are needed to think about, what kind of different moral philosophy, what kind of different political philosophy do we need to have going forward? So my point, Nietzsche's kind of philosophy is something not just for the past. Nietzsche's kind of philosophy is something that has a future. In each of these areas that Nietzsche talks about, it's going to be either a different version of that. For example, in the case of morality, Nietzsche thinks we're going to have morality around, but we have to understand morality differently, because morality is not something with absolutes to it. Morality is more a matter of norms that we fashion in order to have the kind of society we want to make. That's a whole different way to think about morality than the way that was talked about it when it was an absolute edict of God to do this and that. What kind of morality are we still going to want philosophy to be dealing with, not just as a historical fiction historical episode, but something that we do still need, but we need it in a different form. That's the sort of future Nietzsche was trying to move in that direction, move philosophy in that direction, to adapting itself to the real issues and not the ones that were attached to ideas that we don't hold to anymore. Take Nietzsche's kind of philosophy and morph it along the lines that he was trying to morph it. And that's what I'm trying, in the second book, what I try to do is to show how you can take what he's doing in these different areas and then to take that further in the direction that he was starting to go. So I try to show some examples of that.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at philosophy at its root, love of thought, and then if you look at what you're saying as a thought experiment between all of you as academics and your new book, then it doesn't have practical implications. But not to beat a dead horse, which is another really good one-liner in life, and I think is an absolute.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't.
So there's no point in beating dead horses. We can all agree to that.
I can argue against that now. Now that I know how you talk, I can argue against that. There might be a point in beating a dead horse. Like, you don't want the flies.
If you're going to tenderize the meat, for example, then you want to beat it.
Or get rid of all the flies. There's lots of reasons. But what I'm trying to get at is this. We live in a world in which a new type of philosophy seems to be necessary. But what you're saying is your book and the real world are two separate things. And I'm trying to mold them together into one thing. That is what your book is about. I read your book and I say, oh, I get it. This is what Nietzsche said that we're going to need to do in order to something. And the something to me is in order to create a better world, to create people who understand things better, people who understand their fellow human beings, people who are able to make the quantum leap or the paradigm shift, which you've been familiar with since you were a kid.
Right.
So yes, is a paradigm, okay. Did Nietzsche feel that there's a paradigm shift necessary? Is that what the Overman is?
Well, I would say, a paradigm. I thought that you were taking this in the idea in the direction of the paradigm of say moral philosophy that was modeled on the idea that God gives the rules and so it's a divine version of what morality is. And now if we change that.
I'm looking at it like, there's Ukraine, there's Palestine, there's a philosophy. Is there an intersection? Is there some kind of Venn diagram in which Nietzsche's work could somehow, if not that it'll ever happen, but if someone thought about Nietzsche's work and thought about what's happening in certain situations in the world, perhaps things could go slightly different or a different realization could happen and, there'd be world peace or something like that. Well, otherwise, what's really the point?
I think, one thing that can be the point, I really wish some more people would do philosophical thinking is because you need to be a good thinker in order to deal with the problems of the world that is we're asking our politicians to do, we as the voters are trying to do. You've got to be able to think through very complicated problems that don't you can't just simplify them the way some politicians like to do. And you, first of all, you've got to get things basically right, but you've got to also understand complexity. You've got to learn to think about action taken when there are no absolutes to guide you, when you've got some values to guide you, which you hope to share with others. But I don't want the people in the White House to be academic philosophers. What I want them to have done is to acquire philosophical abilities to sort out complex problems and make good arguments and make good criticisms and work with the kinds of values that we when we sort it all out, we want to live by. Those are the kinds of things that philosophy can and should help with for people who aren't doing philosophy, but who are trying to solve problems, whether it's Palestine or any other political problem, or the problems of having 10 billion people in the world and things are not going so well. I mean, there are problems. We need to think about them. And philosophical thinking can help as a kind of training exercise for real world thinking. And the better you are at the one, better you may be with the other. So that's the kind of help I think that philosophy can most provide to the world with its problems. But I think you need a concept of moral philosophy that matches up to the kind of thing morality can really be, as opposed to the thing we used to want it to be. So being realistic about this is a good thing.
Well, that's a good place to end it, because we could go on forever, but I'd have to stop and go get both Tylenol and perhaps some Valium.
I just suggest a glass of wine. We made it a little early today, but
maybe, I don't know. Maybe just a beer or maybe some scotch. I don't know. But anyway, I really enjoyed the book. I wasn't sure. I was scared to read it, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm really looking forward to the next one. And I'll probably spend till 4 o'clock in the morning watching YouTube videos about Nietzsche, of which there are thousands.
Yeah, we won't even go into that because it's too much fun. So no. It's okay. Been
important. I've really enjoyed it. I'm sorry if I was like mean. I don't know if I was mean or not.
We don't know any such thing. I mean,
no.
It's a good interaction to have, and I'd like you to ask these questions. It's the kind of questions that I would like more people to be asking.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.